with jokes that guaranteed a laugh, so as to uplift the hearer and not humiliate the teller. But what could he do? There was no laughter in him to be summoned.
"Well, sir, let me tell the other un, seeing as it's studied out."
Father Tim nodded. If he could just lie down.
"Three preachers was settin' around talkin', don't you know. First un said, 'You uns ought to see the bats I've got a-flyin' around in my church attic. I've tried about everything, but nothin' scares 'em off.' Next un says, 'Law, we've got hundreds of 'em livin' in our belfry. I done had the whole place fumigated, but can't get rid of 'em at all.' Last un said, 'Shoot, I baptized every one of mine, made 'em members of the church, and ain't seen nary one since.'"
Father Tim shook his head. It was hopeless. He wanted to crawl in a hole, go out in the garden and eat worms, whatever. It was useless. He was useless. Tears sprang to his eyes. The old man appeared mortified.
"Lord help! I've done went and made you bawl."
"No, no, that's fine, Uncle Billy. I don't know. I'll make it up to you somehow. I'm just not—"
"I ain't going to take it personal, preacher. No, sir. We're going to try again is what we're going to do."
Here was a challenge, and he was determined to meet it.
"You uns just sit right there a day or two, and I'll be back, don't you know."
Uncle Billy rose stiffly and shuffled toward the door.
"I'm through with my turn, Ms. Cavanaugh."
Cynthia came into the room, clearly pleased with the way things were going so far. "Uncle Billy, there's cake and ice cream in the kitchen. We'd like you to celebrate with us."
"I'll just carry mine home for Rose, and much obliged."
"I don't know," she said. "It's awfully warm to be carrying ice cream home." Uncle Billy pondered the import of toting ice cream from here to the town museum in 90-degree heat. Here was another challenge, and he was determined to meet it.
"I'll have to trot to do it," he said. "But fix it up for me, if you don't object. Rose'll be expecting it."
"Timothy, Emma's here to see you. Would you like another glass of water?" Water. There was cake and ice cream in the kitchen, and he was offered water. Water and Emma Newland. No wonder he'd never been much on birthdays.
"Happy birthday!"
Emma, it seemed, had grown larger, much larger than she'd been only a few weeks ago. Or perhaps he had grown smaller. He had a terrible urge to rise and somehow defend himself, but he sat like a rock. His dog went to Emma and sniffed her bare legs.
"He smells Snickers," she said,
thumping into the leather chair and rustling a sheaf of papers.
"I've been on the Internet."
And he felt interested in something for the first time today. If he couldn't have cake and ice cream, he would have email. She held up one of the papers and squinted at it.
"Listen to this. This is a good one. Read the Bible. It'll scare the hell out of you."
There was a dull silence.
"You're not laughing," she said, accusing.
"It's not funny."
"I laughed," she said archly.
"Yes, well, what you just read is a very serious statement. And true, I might add. Wish I'd said it." She shrugged.
"Listen to this one. War dims hope for peace."
He stared at her.
"That's funny," she said, huffed.
"What is this stuff, anyway?"
"From here out, it's blooper headlines, the kind J.C. Hogan writes, only better."
He sighed.
"I'll just read the whole list. Maybe you'll find one you like," she said, pursing her lips.
He felt oddly threatened. Why didn't his wife come in here and help him out?
"Police begin campaign to run down jaywalkers."
He leaned over and scratched his dog behind the ears.
"Drunks get 9 months in violin case." Stolen painting found by tree.
I don't get it.
You wouldn't, she said, clearly miffed. Typhoon rips through cemetery, hundreds dead. Miners refuse to work after death. If strike isn't settled quickly, it may last a while.
She stuffed the papers in her pocketbook and glared at him as if he were a beetle on a pin.
So how's Harold? He asked.
Scott Murphy came in quietly, squatted before his chair, took Father Tim's hands in his, and said, "Let me pray for you, Father."
Someone to pray for the priest.
His head was pounding, but he wouldn't say a word about it. He would ride this mule.
"Who else?" he asked Cynthia.
"Just George and Harley. I'm letting them both in at once. They'll be good medicine."
"Yes," he said, brightening.
"Everyone wants to see you. They're clamoring for a visit."
"I miss the girls," he said, referring to Puny and the twins.
"So do I. They'll come on Sunday. How's that?"
He thought she looked worn, pale around the gills. It was all this messing with him, of course, day after day.
"Do you feel like seeing J.C. Hogan?"
"No, absolutely not."
"I told him I'd call if you felt up to it, but he'll understand. Percy and Mule wanted to come too, but I thought it best to wait till another time."
"Another time?" he snapped. "How many of these little galas are you and Wilson drumming up? I expect to be on the street any day now. I'll go see Percy myself."
"Timothy, don't be peevish."
Cynthia bounded from the sofa and trotted to the kitchen, his dog behind her.
"And another thing. Why was everybody trying to make him laugh? And why couldn't he just give them a good, rollicking chortle and get this ridiculous business behind him? It would put an end to their torment, for heaven's sake. He thought of the pressure they must be under, trudging in with the awful responsibility of trying to make the preacher laugh. He could see them huddled in the yard, inquiring of the poor souls leaving the house, 'Did you make him laugh?' 'No, but we'll be back with more ammunition. He can't hold out forever.' He was ashamed that he couldn't attain to the high summit of their hopes and affections. George and Harley didn't appear to want anything from him. They weren't trying to make him do something he didn't want to do or couldn't.
"Thank you," he said, as they looked through the study window to an unobstructed view of Baxter Park. "I don't know when I've ever received such a marvelous gift."
"If I'd knowed you wanted it done," said Harley, "it had been done a long time ago."
"I never knew I wanted it done till the other day. How's the Mustang coming?"
"Looking brand new. Showroom."
Father Tim thought Harley's grin might wrap clear around his head. "George is helping with the front fender. I done the grill myself."
"George, it seems like we're working you pretty hard right out of the box."
"Good, Father, I need it." "How are your quarters? Is Harley snoring too loud?"
George Gaynor smiled. "No, sir. I'm afraid I'm the one rattling the windows."
"We've got a lot to talk about. Let's have a visit soon."
"Yes, sir, I'd like that."
"What about your new job at the bookstore?"
"I'm getting the hang of it. Prison offered a lot of opportunities. One was a chance to learn the computer. I think we'll be able to move quite a few rare books via the Internet."
"If you run across a first edition of Wilberforce, keep me in mind."
"Let's sit, why don't we?"
Was he shuffling like Uncle Billy? His legs were dead weight.
His guests took the sofa, and he the chair, as his wife came in with a tray and set it on the coffee table. After serving George and Harley, she turned to him with a certain happiness. "For you, dearest." She handed him a plate of ice cream and cake.
"But
he said, dumbfounded. Sugar-free? Low-fat? No sodium? The whole nine yards? I wanted it to be a surprise. Happy birthday.
He took the plate from her, deeply moved. Barnabas leaped into his slip-covered chair. A junco called outside the open windows. George and Harley eagerly tucked into their refreshments, as did he. Peace at last, he thought, feeling suddenly uplifted. He and Cynthia had filled the dishwasher and turned it on when the doorbell rang.
"Ugh," she said, trooping down the hall.
"Bishop!"
"How are you, dear girl?"
Blast! He'd completely forgotten the email, forgotten to tell Cynthia. It hadn't crossed his mind since he left the hospital.
The subsiding headache cranked up again, pounding in his left temple. He looked at the clock above the refrigerator. 4:30. A fine time to go knocking on people's doors.
"Chuck Albright is with me," said Stuart. "I dropped him at the local, where he's buying liver mush to ship home in dry ice. Where we come from, liver mush is hard to find."
"With good reason," said Father Tim, who never touched the stuff. They sat in the study, which was flooded with afternoon light. Father Tim thought Stuart looked surprisingly older, frayed somehow.
"Do you feel like telling me everything?" asked the bishop.
He didn't want to talk about it. Surely someone had given Stuart the details. Everybody knew what had happened. He plunged ahead, however, dutiful. "I blacked out at the wheel of my car and hit Bill Sprouse, who pastors First Baptist. He was walking his dog. His dog was killed instantly. Bill had several fractures and a mild concussion." He took a deep breath. "He's going to be all right." That was the first time he'd given anyone a synopsis, and he had made it through. His headache was blinding.
"Yes, I heard all that, and God knows I'm sorry. What I'd really like to hear is how you are in your soul."
"Ah, my soul." He put his hand to his forehead, speechless.
"The Eucharist, then," said Stuart. He bolted from the chair, took his home communion kit from the kitchen island, and brought it to the coffee table.
Father Tim watched his bishop open the mahogany box to reveal the small water and wine cruets, a silver chalice and paten, a host box, and a crisply starched fair linen.
"I was reminded the other day," said Stuart, "that when St. John baptized Christ, he was touching God. An awesome and extraordinary thing to consider. When we receive the bread and blood, we also are touching God." Stuart poured the wine and drizzled a small amount of water into each glass.
"I know you recognize that wondrous fact, dear brother, but sometimes it's good to be reminded."
Heavenly Father, giver of life and health, comfort and hope, please visit us with such a strong sense of your presence that we may trust faithfully in your mighty strength and power, in your wisdom vastly beyond our understanding, and in your love which surrounds us for all eternity. At this time, we ask your grace especially upon Timothy, that he may know your gift of a heart made joyous and strong by faith. Bless Cynthia, too, we pray, whose eager hands and heart care for him.
As Father Tim knelt by the coffee table next to his wife, the tears began, and he didn't try to check them.
The cathedral? He stood at the front door with Stuart, drawing upon the very dregs of his strength to inquire about the bishop's grand passion.
"That's why I'm racing out of here to Charlotte,"
Someone's making a gift of $500,000.
You're looking weary, my friend.
Yes, I am that.
You're still afraid to take a break, to rest a while?
I can't. The cathedral.
Of course.
There was irony in Stuart's smile.
Besides, I'll be 72 soon enough, and forced to rest a while.
The bishop kissed him on either cheek and opened the door. You and Cynthia are ever in my prayers, Timothy. He will put things right, and don't forget it. That's what he's about, after all, putting things right.
The Lord be with you, Stuart, and also with you. Give Martha our love.
Will do.
He watched as Stuart walked briskly to his car and climbed in.
Father!
Helene Pringle darted from the side of the house and hastened up the steps to his front stoop. Apparently, she'd popped through the hedge, wearing blue-striped oven mitts and bearing a dish covered by a tea towel.
For you!
She thrust her offering at him with seeming joy, but how could he take it from her if oven mitts were required to handle it? He stepped back. Miss Pringle stepped in.
"Roast poulet," she exclaimed, "with olive oil and garlic, and stuffed with currants. I so hope you and Cynthia, like it."
"Helene," his wife sailed down the hall,
"what have you done? What smells so heavenly?" "Roast poulet,"
Miss Pringle exclaimed again, as if announcing royalty.
"Oh, my," said Cynthia. "Let me just get a towel."
She trotted to the bathroom at the end of the hall and was back in a flash.
"Thank you very much, Helene. I'll take it. Lovely. Won't you come in?" "Oh, no, no, indeed. I don't wish to interfere. I hope, that is, I heard about..."
She paused, turning quite red.
"Merci, Father. Cynthia, bon appétit. Au revoir."
She was gone down the walk, quick as a hare.
"I like her mitts," said Cynthia.
"Delicious." He spooned the thick currant sauce over a slice of tender breast meat and nudged aside the carrots Cynthia had cooked.
"Outstanding!"
He ate heartily, as if starved. He glanced up to see his wife looking at him.
"What?"
he asked.
"I haven't seen you eat like this in quite a while."
"Excellent flavor. I suppose it's the currants."
"I suppose," she said.
The morning of his nativity might have begun last week or last month. Indeed, it seemed an eternity since he waked to the kisses of his wife. He rolled over in bed and tried again to position his head on the pillow so he could gain a bit of comfort and sleep. He looked at the clock face, glowing green in the dark room. 2 o'clock. His wife had given the party to cheer and encourage him, and surely underneath his exhaustion was a gladness of heart that he would feel tomorrow, after he'd rested. In all the uproar, he realized he'd forgotten something terribly important. Not only had it been his birthday, it was also the anniversary of his proposal to Cynthia. They had a tradition of celebrating that momentous occasion with his birthday, and heretofore he had always remembered. This time he'd forgotten entirely, and now it was too late. He wondered if he really would get his strength back in the 6 weeks Hoppy had mentioned, or whether he was being sucked into the same quagmire that had destroyed his father. No matter what he did these last few weeks, or how hard he tried, he failed himself and everyone else. He failed to be cheerful and quick, to rise to the occasion, to look at life with thanksgiving and approval. There was a growing coldness in him, in some deep place he'd never gone before. In truth, he often felt himself sinking out of control. Perhaps his father had been out of control. Perhaps depression had made him unable to restrain the cold severity toward his wife and son. Perhaps there was no controlling such a thing once it took root in the spirit. Then again, his father had claimed no God, no redeeming Christ, while he, the son, had claimed it all. Mercy and forgiveness, unconditional love, and the capstone of the faith, salvation. So what was his excuse? Barnabas followed him downstairs and lay in the soft pool of lamplight as he opened his Bible to the second letter of Timothy. He'd read the two epistles on almost every birthday since his 12th year. His mother had instructed him in this habit, and as a serious youngster, he imagined the letter to have been written across the centuries, personally and directly to him, Timothy Cavanaugh. He still believed this to be true in some supernatural way. He read aloud, knowing his dog would listen. "Continue in what you have learned and firmly believed, knowing from whom you learned it, and how from childhood you have known the sacred writings that are able to instruct you for salvation through faith in Christ Jesus. Always be sober, endure suffering, do the work of an evangelist, carry out your ministry fully." Carry out your ministry fully. This was the line that every year stopped him cold, wondering, was he carrying out his ministry fully? A few times in his priesthood, he'd actually believed that he was. Now, of course, things were different. He could journey no further with Paul tonight. Recently, he'd become aware, however dimly, that he was looking for something in the Scriptures. He felt desperate for a specific message from God, yet he didn't know what it might be. He knew only that it would be direct, meant profoundly for him, and that he'd recognize it instantly when at last it was revealed. He thumbed the Scriptures in reverse order to the voice of David, a voice that might have been his own. "Hear my prayer, O Lord, and let my cry come unto thee. Hide not thy face from me in the day when I am in trouble. Incline thine ear unto me. In the day when I call, answer me speedily. For my days are consumed like smoke, and my bones are burned as an hearth. My heart is smitten and withered like grass, so that I forget to eat my bread. By reason of the voice of my groaning, my bones cleave to my skin. I am like a pelican of the wilderness. I am like an owl of the desert. I watch and am as a sparrow alone upon the housetop. My days are like a shadow that declineth, and I am withered like grass." He heard a sound behind him and turned, startled. "Timothy!" "I couldn't sleep." "Nor I." "Forgive me for forgetting." He made a move to rise and go to her, but she came to him.
"It's all right."
"It isn't all right. I'm sorry." She kissed him on his forehead.
"What are you reading?"
"The 102nd Psalm."
"Let me read to you, dearest. I know how you love that. May I?"
"Yes," he said, giving her his Bible. She glanced at the open book.
"I'll read the very next one, the 103rd. Come, let's sit on the sofa where there's a breeze through the windows."
She turned on the lamp and settled into her end of the sofa. He sat beside her, thankfully, realizing how happy he was to see her, to have her company. "Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me, bless his holy name." He put his head back against the cushion and closed his eyes. His wife had a gift for reading scripture, as if it were hot off the press. "Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits. Who forgiveth all thine iniquities? Who healeth all thy diseases? Who redeemeth thy life from destruction? Who crowneth thee with loving kindness and tender mercies? Who satisfieth thy mouth with good things, so that thy youth is renewed like the eagles? As far as the east is from the west, so far hath he removed our transgressions from us. For he knoweth our frame, he remembereth that we are dust. Bless ye the Lord, all ye his hosts, ye ministers of his that do his pleasure. Bless the Lord, O my soul." He knew only that she covered him with the afghan, and he slept soundly until morning. Chapter 10 Up and Doing. As he turned the pages of his desk calendar, he discovered the date marked for the trip to New York. The trip was only days away. Maybe he should call the airline and cancel. Maybe they could get a refund. But Cynthia mustn't miss this. She could go without him, and he'd try and get a refund on his own ticket. There was no way under heaven that he could face a trip to New York and a high-powered social event into the bargain. But he hated that she'd have to go alone. They'd been so positive, so happy about going together. He got up and walked to the window and stared at the maple tree, unseeing. Who could accompany his wife and look out for her and take her to the awards dinner and see her safely to and from the hotel and the airport? The answer came at once. And at once he knew it was right. He was dozing on the sofa when someone knocked at the back door. Though unshaven and in the shabbiest of his sweatsuits, he went to the door and opened it, eager for company. "I come to check on you," said Harley. "It's my afternoon off." "Come in, come in. I'm glad to see you. I wanted to bring you a pan of brownies, but it'd be outright first-degree homicide, so I brung you this." Harley withdrew his hand from behind his back and offered a fistful of Malmaison roses from a bed at the old rectory. Father Tim looked at them with amazement. He'd quite forgotten about his roses. "You could put them in a show," said Harley. How could he have forgotten about his roses? "Sit down, Harley, sit down. I need the company. I've missed you." He ran water into a vase he found in the cabinet and arranged the pink roses, which were just unfurling their petals. Breathtaking. He would look for the camera and take a picture. He carried them into the study and put the vase on the mantel where he could see it from the sofa. Then he thumped into the hollow he'd made in the cushion during the last weeks. "Tell me everything," he said with interest. "How are you pushing along with George?"
"Real good. He ain't much in the kitchen, so I cook and he does the wash-up. He puts his britches on a hanger and keeps his room like he was in the armed service. I reckon he learned that in the penitentiary. He's trying to teach me poetry. Said he had a class in the pen that got him to liking poetry. Said it helped him exercise his mind."
"Have you learned a few lines?"
"Somebody's always trying to teach me something I ain't interested in learning. Let's see if I can say that in a Mr. Longfellow's."
Harley propped his elbows on his knees and dropped his head into his hands.
"All right, now I'm studying on it."
There was a long pause.
"Okay, here goes. Lives of great men all remind us we can make our lives sublime, and departing leave behind us footprints on the sands of time."
"Well done."
"Let's see, there was another line or two. Let us then be up and doing with a heart for any fate." "Any fate."
Harley looked up, defeated.
"It's gone out of my noggin."
Father Tim grinned. still achieving, still pursuing, learn to labor and to wait.
That's it.
I learned that poem as a youngster. Lace would be proud of you.
I miss that, young'un.
What else is going on? Tell me news of the outside world.
Well, let's see. Ain't much to tell. Old man Mueller brought his rattletrap car in today. I got to work on it tomorrow.
What's wrong with it?
Says it won't turn right. Says it won't go in the direction of his politics.
Uh-huh.
Hadn't turned right in 2 or 3 weeks, he said.
How did he get around? Asked Father Tim. A man has to turn right once in a while.
Well, generally, if he was going to town, he'd turn right out of his driveway. But since he can't turn right, they won't nothing to do but put her in reverse, back all the way to the shed, go around behind that old barn that fell down, and circle around till he ended up beside his front porch.
Still in reverse?
That's what he said.
How come he couldn't turn around in front of his house?
Got a cornfield right up to his front door, and another one to the left.
Father Tim shook his head as if to clear it.
So once he was headed out beside his porch, he could turn left and go to town.
If I couldn't turn right, let's see, how would I get to town? A man who didn't have anything better to do than this didn't deserve anything better to do. Harley stared fixedly at the wall, thinking,
Well, Reverend, you'd have to back out of your garage and turn left. That'd head you to Church Hill, where you'd turn left again. Then you'd turn left on Lilac Road and hang a left on Main Street.
He grinned broadly, revealing pink gums.
There you go. Nothing but left turns in that deal.
Piece of cake, said Father Tim. He didn't know why exactly, but a visit from Harley always did him a world of good. In truth, he felt the courage to ask what had been on his mind daily, and what Harley would surely know. Harley, what are they saying on the street? Harley looked sober.
Saying it could have been a whole lot worser.
The clock ticked on the mantel.
Nobody holds it agin you.
Nobody?
No, sir. And if you don't mind me saying so, I wish you wouldn't hold it agin yourself.
He sat silent for a moment. I'll try, Harley. I'm going to try. Harley nodded encouragement.
That's all a man can do, he said.
The more he thought about it, and he fervently hoped he'd never think about it again, he wondered why old man Mueller didn't make a U-turn beside his porch when he came home from town, which would head him in the proper direction for the next go-around. Come to think of it, why was old man Mueller driving at all? Wasn't he well into his 90s? And all that backing up? Good grief! He went to the kitchen and opened the refrigerator door, and stared blankly at the contents.
Bill, it's Tim. How are you doing?
When the Lord ordains, he sustains. I'm doing all right, brother, and I hope you are.
Yes, Bill. I hope it's okay for me to suggest this.
What's that?
It was tough to say, but he had to get it behind him. I've been thinking that... He cleared his throat and made a fresh start. Whenever the time seems right, I'd like to buy you a dog.
I appreciate it, but I've never had a bought dog. The Lord always sends my dogs. Except for Hoover. I believe the other party sent Hoover.
No, I appreciate it, Tim, but whenever it's time, my dog will come along. He didn't know where else to go with this. It seemed there was nothing he could do for Bill Sprouse. He wanted desperately to minister to him in some way, yet Bill never seemed to need it. In truth, Bill's faith seemed stronger, his confidence surer, his hope brighter than his own.
He sat in the place he'd worn for himself on the sofa,
wishing, if only for a moment, that Bill had been driving the car, and he'd been the one standing by the stop sign. Uncle Billy Watson dragged a chrome dinette chair from the kitchen to the dining room, where stacks of newspapers stood higher than the heads of most men. It took a while to climb onto the chair seat and stand up so he could reach the top of the stack. Because he didn't do this often, he forgot now and again what he'd hidden up there. Today he was looking for a special copy of the Farmer's Almanac, but hoped he might find a little cash money while he was at it. He used to hide his money under the mattress, but Rose had found out, and that was the last he ever saw of 2 fifties and a 10 he'd made from building birdhouses. What a man had to do was feel around real gentle, because if you poked your hand in a stack too forceful, it might come down all over creation. When newspapers were stacked up, they had a way of slithering like snakes. You couldn't trust what they might do. The town inspector had threatened to haul off the whole shebang, but he'd never gone through with it. Uncle Billy figured it must be a low-down kind of job to have, to go into people's houses and tell them what they could hang on to and what had to be hauled off. He'd be willing to give the newspapers to a paper drive, if they ever had such a thing anymore, but he hadn't heard of a paper drive in a coon's age. No, sir. Now they wanted you to bundle the dad-jing things up and set them on the street in a red rubber bucket. On top of that, the town give a man a blue rubber bucket for glass and a white rubber bucket for periodicals. Red, blue, white. It was all too much to keep up with. Him and Rose put everything in a grocery bag when they could think of it and set it in a garbage can he'd found in a dumpster. That ought to be enough for a man to lawfully do with his garbage, this side of digging a hole and burying it hisself. He pawed around on top of the stack, trying desperately to locate the almanac he clearly remembered putting up here. It had been full of good jokes, about as good as any he'd seen in a while. But if he'd left it out on a table where it ought to be, Rose would have done Lord knows what with it, peeled potatoes on it, or set a cook-pot on it, or cut recipes out of it. He never knew why his wife cut out recipes when she'd never made anything from a recipe in her life. Heaven knows he'd made plenty of things from recipes he remembered from his boyhood. He had stood by his mama's table in that little cabin in the woods and watched her roll out dough for biscuits and pies, and he didn't know what all. He'd learned to cook creases with fatback, and make rabbit stew, and even use a wood stove oven to bake deer meat with vinegar, spring water, lard, and wild onions. You had to cover your skillet good and tight, though, or your meat would dry out and be tough as wit leather. He stopped trying to find the almanac and wondered, as he usually did, how in the dickens he'd get down from the chair. He nearly always forgot how hard it was to climb down once he climbed up. Seemed like lately his arthritis was making his limbs so stiff that when the Lord called him home, he'd be coffin ready. It was a real aggravation to find a decent joke these days. Sometimes he thought he'd quit joke-telling. Just put it all behind him. Retire, you might say. Only thing was, he liked to hear people laugh. Yes, sir, that was about as good a feeling as a man could get without costing an arm and a leg. Maybe he'd hid the almanac in that little pantry off the kitchen. He held on to the back of the chair and looked down. "Go easy," he cautioned himself aloud. The chair wobbled as he lifted his right foot off the seat and set it on the floor. Boys, how did that done it? That sent a pain up his leg that would lay out a mule. He lifted the other foot off the chair seat, set it down, and felt the solid floor beneath. That was 2 feet set down, and all they was to set down, thank God Almighty. Famed local Arthur to receive award. Mitford's biggest celebrity,
Ms. Cynthia Coppersmith Cavanaugh will travel to New York City on Thursday to receive one of publishing's highest honors. In a ceremony at the Waldorf Astoria, she will be given her second Davant Medal in recognition of her series of %mark books about a white cat, Violet, who is an actual cat that lives right here in Mitford with Ms. Cavanaugh and her husband. A publicity release from Ms. Cavanaugh's publisher states that no other Arthur has ever won the medal twice. Insiders say the Davant Medal is right up there with an Oscar. Yvette Harris, head librarian at the Mitford Volunteer Library, says, "Violet personifies today's liberated woman. She thinks for herself, isn't afraid to learn new things, and manages to get out of many interesting scrapes." Ms. Cavanaugh has been drawing and writing little stories since she was 10 years old. Her first book was about a doodle bug, though it was never published. Her numerous Violet books include Violet Goes to the Country, Violet Visits the Queen, and Violet Goes to School. Ms. Cavanaugh also goes to school, as she reads to local students several times a year. Other book jaunts take her, %mark, Wesley, Holding, and many surrounding communities. "She is our favorite Arthur," says Doreen Little, who received last year's Teacher of the Year award at Mitford School. "Boys and girls alike can identify with Violet, who is more of a real person than a cat, if you ask me." The Arthur has also been invited to tour America with a literacy program called Read, along with other famous children's book Arthurs, which departs on August 5th. Ms. Cavanaugh will be accompanied to New York by Dooley Russell Barlow of Mitford, who is a rising sophomore at the University of Georgia. "Ugh," said his wife. "Who writes this stuff?" "Mostly J.C., but sometimes he hires help." "I mean, really, today's liberated woman? And who are these insiders? And the spelling, the lowliest school computer has spell check." His wife was hot, and no two ways about it. "Not to mention this picture of me. Where on earth did he dig it up? It's older than dirt. I'm wearing a beehive." "Here," he said, taking the newspaper from her. "Why rile yourself?" "Does he ever talk to the subject of his little butcher jobs? Or is all his reportage done by hearsay and rumor? I never wrote a book about a doodle bug." "What was it about?" "A ladybug," she said, thoroughly disgusted. He patted her hand. "Now, now, Cavanaugh." She looked at him a moment, then fell back against the sofa cushions, hooting with laughter. They walked to the garden bench and sat watching the moon rise over Baxter Park. "My dear John," she said, fingering his silver tresses. "Who's John?" "You know, sweetheart, John the Baptist." He sighed. "Maybe I'll cut it myself." "I'll do it as soon as I come home. How's that?" "No way," he said, kissing her cheek. "I've witnessed your tonsorial skills." "I don't want to leave you, Timothy. But of course you must. It's the only thing to do." "Thank you, darling." "I'll be fine. I am fine. There's nothing at all to worry about. Puny will be here every day, and the girls will come straight from daycare in the afternoons. Dooley and I will call you in the morning, and of course we'll call you after the awards dinner. Then we'll call you the next morning, and after lunch, and after the play, and before we leave for the airport. You'll be sick of hearing from us."
"Never."
"Thank you for buying the theater tickets, dearest. For taking care of everything. Dooley is so excited, you'd think we're going to the moon." "It's time we did something special for that boy. Besides, I can't think of anyone I'd rather send you off with." His heart was heavy, but he made certain his voice was light.
Nearly 40 years in the pulpit taught a man how to hide his personal feelings. "Please don't be sad," she said, putting her head on his shoulder. "Sad? How could I be sad?" He kissed her forehead. "You're the first author ever to win the Davant Medal twice." He wanted his wife to have a life apart from nursing him, like some hothouse orchid. He really did. "Give her your arm when you cross the street, like this," he demonstrated. "Why?" asked Dooley. "Because there's a lot of traffic in New York, and it's dangerous up there. Because she's a woman. And because, as a man, it's your job." "I never heard of that job."
"You heard it here first."
Dooley grinned. "I'll take care of her, I promise."
"You've got my card. Pick a good restaurant, ask someone at the awards dinner to recommend a good place. She likes French or Italian. Call ahead and make a reservation. They're big on reservations in New York."
"Okay, cool."
"Take taxis. Do whatever you need to do.
Here's $100.
And be sure and tip the bellman who carries your luggage to your rooms."
"I can carry our luggage."
"They won't let you."
"But it's our luggage."
"Yes, well, don't ask me to explain. And when the tab comes at the restaurant, tip 20%.
"Man!"
"Just put it on the card. And while we're on the subject, hold on to your wallet. And help Cynthia watch her pocketbook. She's been known to set it on a counter while she shops. Do you need to write any of this down?"
"No, sir."
"Good." On second thought, he dug into his pocket and pulled out his wallet. "Here's another 100, just in case. And 20 for you."
"Wow," said Dooley, taking the bills. "I always wanted to carry this stuff around."
"One more thing. Buy flowers somewhere. They usually have flowers on the street. Give them to Cynthia."
"When?"
"Whenever you pass a flower stall. Pink roses only, no red. Or white tulips, if they don't have roses."
"Okay."
"A dozen. Tell her they're from me."
"Yes, sir."
"Any questions?"
"No, sir."
"Well done." He'd never felt so proud in his life. He could send this young man on a mission and trust him to complete it. He felt his chest literally expand as he embraced the boy who'd come into his life and changed it forever. He stood at the garage door and watched Dooley back the Mazda onto Wisteria Lane.
"We love you," Cynthia called.
"Love you back." He waved until the car disappeared from view beyond the hedge, then hurried to the edge of the yard, where he could watch them turn left on Main Street. He had hoped to feel better about being alone. This way he could be as grumpy as he liked, and no one would notice or care. But he felt bereft. He opened the refrigerator door and stared inside, then shut the door without remembering what he'd seen. He walked into the study and turned on the lamp by his chair and gazed out the window to Baxter Park, noting the lowering sky. A book. Of course. That was the ticket. He took a volume from the shelf and sat in his armchair and was thankful for his good dog snoring at his feet. Then he opened the book to a random page and gazed at it for some time. There was nothing in the book but words. The storm reached Mitford shortly after dark. He'd taken Barnabas to the backyard as the rain began, fat, pelting drops that smarted when they hit his shirt. At 10 o'clock, a full-bore electrical storm was up and running, dousing power in the village and waking him from a deep sleep. A dazzling flash of platinum lit the room. He turned on his side and listened to the pounding of rain on the roof and the great flume of water flushing through the downspouts. He hadn't taken his medication for depression. He would leave it off for a few days and see what happened. It was humiliating to be taking such a thing,
The only consolation was that millions of others were in the same boat. Depression was common, run-of-the-mill stuff. But he'd never aspired to being run-of-the-mill. He was certain that in a few days his energy would increase, his spirits would be stronger, his outlook brighter, and this whole miserable experience would be over. He was clinging to the rock, trusting it to cleft for him. The vacuum cleaner was going full throttle, as were the washing machine, dryer, and pressure cooker. He liked to stay as far away as possible from pressure cookers. A neighbor in Holly Springs had scrubbed green beans off every surface, including the ceiling, for 2 weeks. But today's rumbling, hissing, churning, and roaring created a welcome cacophony in the yellow house, and he was grateful. "To reach the port of heaven," he inscribed in his quote journal, "we must sail sometimes with the wind and sometimes against it. But we must sail, and not drift, nor lie at anchor." Oliver Wendell Holmes had hit the nail on the head. He closed the book from which he'd gleaned the quote, and gazed into the park. He could kid himself into believing he was drifting. The truth was, he was lying at anchor. He'd tried more than once to get back to his essays, yet had drawn a blank over and over again. He was spending time looking at the maple tree, rather than pursuing the progress of what he'd titled The Future Hour. As open and bright as their house might be, it was feeling like a prison. He wanted out of here. He rose suddenly, and went to the back door, and opened it wide. He would take the girls to Sweet Stuff as soon as they arrived. He not only needed the fresh mountain air, he needed to see people face to face, so that he might look into their eyes and read their judgments, if any. He had dreaded his excursion onto the street. Now he was ready to get it behind him. "Don't overdo it," Wilson had said. "Whatever energy is there will burn off quickly." Yes, but he couldn't go on living to himself, in himself. It was sickening. He snatched the cordless from the hook before the answering machine kicked in. He'd hardly picked up the phone in weeks. His wife was on orders from the doctor to keep such stimulants at a minimum. However, if he was well enough to push along on his own, he was certainly entitled to answer the blasted phone. "I can't believe it," huffed Emma. "What can't you believe?" "That I'm talking to you. I was beginning to wonder if you were dead or alive." "All of the above," he said. "And your emails stacking up over here like... Emma had never been good at analogy. "Like planes over Atlanta." "Right. You'll never guess what's going on in Whitecap." "How fast can you get over here?" he said. As he hung up, he was distinctly aware that he was grinning. Email. "Dear Father, it has been ages since your friends at Whitecap have heard a peep out of you. Your good secretary emailed us to say you haven't been up to par. How distressing to hear this, and please take care of yourself. Hardly a day passes that we don't speak of you at the library, where I am serving my last season as head. How quickly time passes. It has been more years than I care to remember. I think they are plotting to give me a first edition of Agatha Christie's autobiography, still in its dust jacket. Be warned that I have not gotten the knack of writing those short email messages that seem so popular with one and all. I hope you are still interested in news from our little island, as there seems to be quite a lot of it these days. We hear a wall has been erected on the yellow line between the bait and tackle shop and Mona's. We don't know what this portends. We are hoping it is not a forecast of any more drastic action, such as divorce. Do pray, as I know how much Ernie means to you. Morris is still playing the organ each Sunday, but we haven't been able to get him to stay for the coffee minute afterward. Jean Ballinger has taken it upon herself to work on this.
I'm not sure she's the one for the job. She may scare him off completely. I do believe that playing each Sunday has given him a kind of happiness. You should hear the praise heaped upon his head before he manages to get away in the truck with Junior and Misty, who always fetch him back and forth. Have you heard that Junior and Misty are going to have a baby? Junior is very proud. You should see how tenderly he cares for his young bride. Jeffrey Tolson struggles with himself, I think, but is being faithful to his dear family. Jeanette looks wonderful. She has become a truly beautiful girl with the flowering of her marriage. Certainly she isn't forced to work so hard now that Jay has a steady income. Your Jonathan is full of mischief and has stolen every heart in the parish. Otis and Marlene have two new grandchildren and have closed up the pool at their house. Marlene says it is just until the grandchildren get older. Otis says it is for forever and a day, as a pool is nothing but nuisance and expense. He intends to have his construction people fill it with topsoil and plant palm trees therein, though I can't imagine that palms will flourish this far north. I think palmettos might be a better choice. The Duncans have got a new rooster, which makes the neighbors complain. I think the world has gone wrong when one cannot enjoy the sound of a rooster crowing. Father Conklin means well, and heaven knows he tries, but I'm not sure how he will do in the long run, if there is one. I wish all news were good news. Sam is again going into the hospital, this time for a kidney operation. Everyone says it is nothing, not to worry, but of course I do, shame on me. It has never been the same since you left. We would have kept you and Cynthia until the cows come home. Give her my love, and thank you for keeping us in your prayers as we hold you faithfully in ours. I shall not rest until I hear you are feeling hale again. Timothy, for heaven's sake, can you not give a man word of your circumstances? Are you dead as a doornail, or only on the downward spiral toward last rites, which I shall be happy to come and administer, if only you will ask? We are pushing along up here in the wilderness, though frightfully short-handed. I'm wearing out a perfectly good pair of boots, going up hill and down dale, all the while observing the most heartbreaking conditions imaginable. But we are making progress. The good Lord has brought a veritable drove of youngsters to our door, and one or two grim parents. They come out of curiosity and stay for cookies and tea and Bible stories. The flood is a particular favorite. Abner comes daily. I hope you are praying for him, as I requested. Well, brother, have you cast us utterly away? If you cannot write, for heaven's sake, do the next best thing. Send money. Sissy unrolled the watercolor and held it before him. See, Grandpa? This is the church. Will you put it on your refrigerator? Absolutely. Well done. And this, said Sassy, is Barnabas. I used the biggest piece of paper in the whole school. Terrific, he said, admiring the watercolor of a black hulk on a red rug. However, like your subject matter, your painting is bigger than the refrigerator.
You could put it on the wall.
Ah, the wall.
You have tape in your desk drawer. We saw it when we used your colored pencils.
Let me think. Sassy ran to the wall by his desk.
Right here, Grandpa. It would look great. You can take this other stuff down. I want mine on the wall, too, said Sissy. Not on the refrigerator.
Life was short. He went to the desk drawer and got out the tape. Consider it done, he said. Amazing. He'd gone from a hopeless bachelor who lived alone to a man with a dog, a son, a wife, and two grandchildren. Thinking thus,
he marched down Main Street, a red-haired twin on either side, glad to be alive. He was standing at the bakery case with the girls when he heard the door open and the tick, tick, tick of heels on the tile floor. Knowing he was nailed to the wall, he turned to face the onslaught. Fancy Skinner, in her signature uniform of hot pink T-shirt and capri pants, arched one eyebrow and gave him a withering look.
"Long time no see."
"Fancy, how are you?" She was smoking over his hair pretty good, he thought, ducking his head to peer into the bottom shelf of the case.
"Chocolate eclair," said Sassy. "Chocolate chip cookie," crowed Sissy. "I'm having a sugar-free fruit tart," Fancy informed him. "That's my favorite. It sends me over the moon, all that custard and those little slices of kiwi. I hope they have kiwi today. Some days they don't have kiwi. Sometimes it's just raspberries and whatnot. Thank the Lord Winnie never uses blueberries, which I can't stand to put in my mouth. I don't know why. Probably 'cause they turn your tongue blue, even your teeth. And bananas? You take bananas. I have never liked the texture of bananas. I don't care if they do have potassium. They make me feel fat. Don't bananas make you feel fat? But you take kiwi. Now, kiwi is very tropical, very light and refreshing." Actually, he hadn't thought he could have anything. But a sugar-free fruit tart was another matter entirely. He brightened. Winnie blew through the curtains that separated the kitchen from the bake shop.
"Father, I'm so glad to see you. I could hug your neck."
"Come and do it, then." Dear good-hearted Winnie, smelling literally of sugar, spice, and everything nice, trotted from behind the bake case. "How's business?" he asked, relishing her vigorous hug.
"Booming, now that your crowd is here."
After the girls piped their orders, he gave his. "Sugar-free fruit tart," he said with immeasurable anticipation.
"Just one?"
"Just one."
"Good, because that's all that's left."
He had no intention of making eye contact with Fancy Skinner. He devoutly hoped there would never again be a necessity so dire as to force him into her chair.
"For here or to go?" asked Winnie.
"For here," he chorused with the twins. On her way out with a low-fat doughnut, Fancy gave his hair a final look of professional scorn. Or was it downright disgust?
"Do you think Grandpa needs a haircut?" he inquired of his counsel.
"Yes, sir," said Sassy. "You really do."
Sissy nodded, her mouth full. "Well, then," he said, making short work of the tart, which had come fully loaded with kiwi. They'd left the house less than an hour ago, and already his small spring of energy had run utterly dry. As the girls drank soda pop and sweet stuff, he sat in Joe Ivy's barber chair, feeling raw, exposed.
"I probably oughtn't to tell you this."
Snip, snip. Joe began his labors with the hair that had grown over his customer's collar.
"So don't," suggested Father Tim. "But somebody said if you was going to run over a Baptist preacher, you should have aimed for that clown over at Wesley Chapel."
He stiffened.
"Wasn't too funny, was it? I oughtn't to have said that."
Snip, snip.
"You're looking sort of down and out. I guess this has hit you pretty hard."
Snip, snip, snip. The sound of a car horn on Main Street. Footsteps above their heads. Winnie's shop door opening, his blood pressure rising.
"I don't reckon you'd like a little shooter."
"I thought you were keeping away from that stuff," he snapped.
"I am keeping away from it. It's sitting there for my customers."
Next time he needed a haircut, he was going to Wesley or down to Holding. Anywhere but here. He glanced up to the eastern ridge above Mitford, and was surprised to see the chimneys of Clearday, Edith Mallory's rambling stone house, which, he'd been told, boasted roughly 8,000 square feet. Apparently some serious tree work had just been done. He'd liked it better when nothing at all could be seen of her 90-acre property. When he'd been rector at Lord's Chapel, she had often invited the vestry there for meetings. He was thankful to God that he was no longer forced to endure the whole miserable experience, stopping at the electronic gate box and punching in numbers that seemed to change with each meeting, then making the long, dark drive through the narrow tunnel of low-arching rhododendron. He remembered the smothered feeling he often got when coming through that tunnel, followed by a long evening of dodging her attempts to make eye contact, hang on to his arm, or remove non-existent lint from his lapel. Then there was the stormy night the vestry had convened about Hope House. After sending his ride home, while he was in the bathroom, she'd trapped him in her library, where, after a harsh exchange, he'd spent most of the night in a club chair. Ed Coffey had claimed Edith's town car wouldn't start, though he'd gotten the blasted thing started well enough by daylight. Yours truly had been dropped off at the rectory just as his next-door